Alyssa Harris Perry, in for Tenzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway.
This is fundamentally a free speech issue. If you look at the rhetoric of Senator McConnell and of state legislators all across the country that are trying to get bills passed to prohibit the teaching of the 1619 Project, it's not about the facts of history. It's about trying to prohibit the teaching of ideas that they don't like.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones speaking on CNN earlier this month in response to criticism from conservatives about the 1619 Project. Hannah-Jones created and launched the project in August of 2019 to commemorate the arrival of the first enslaved Africans in what would later become the United States. The collaboration of New York Times and New York Times Magazine's writers sought to reorient Americans' understandings of our national story so that it begins not with the Revolutionary War of 1776, but instead with the practice of intergenerational human bondage and its continuing consequences for the nation. Hannah-Jones earned the Pulitzer Prize for her introductory essay to the project. And the 1619 Project was widely heralded. It immediately spawned hundreds of laudatory and thoughtful commentaries, it launched a podcast, it inspired a curriculum, and it drew meaningful criticism, most notably from a group of academic historians who published an open letter in the New York Times disagreeing with the project's core motivation and challenging some of its specific claims. In short, the 1619 Project achieved precisely what both journalism and public scholarship aspire to. It generated influential ideas, which led to meaningful debate in the public sphere. So it's not surprising that faculty and administrators at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where Hannah-Jones received her BA in 2003, were excited about an opportunity to bring her back to campus as a member of the faculty. The university sought to offer Hannah-Jones the university's Knight Chair in Journalism. But last week, the news outlet NC Watch reported that Hannah-Jones was denied tenure as part of her offer to serve as the Knight Chair. The decision to deny her tenure was not made by scholars, or faculty, or peers, or colleagues. It was made by the University of North Carolina Board of Trustees. And let's be clear, the UNC Board of Trustees is not an academic body. It's a political one. North Carolina's Republican-controlled General Assembly appoints the board members, and those appointees are frequently prominent state Republicans, including former lawmakers. It's also worth noting that the board is composed of 12 individuals. 10 are white men, 1 is a white woman, 1 is a black woman. No member of the UNC Board of Trustees has earned a PhD or is a member of any university faculty. Republican politicians across the country have attacked the 1619 Project, and particularly kind of its attempts to be incorporated into school curriculums. Even former President Trump weighed in on Hannah-Jones' work back in 2020.
By viewing every issue through the lens of race, they want to impose a new segregation, and we must not allow that to happen. Critical race theory, the 1619 Project, and the crusade against American history is toxic propaganda.
The decision to deny tenure for Nicole Hannah-Jones is alarming and an indication of much broader issues within higher education. So we begin today with an examination of American higher ed and the ways it is threatened by our deepening partisan divides. I'm joined now by Pedro Noguera, Dean and Distinguished Professor of the USC School of Education. Pedro, it's so great to have you here.
Hi, Melissa.
Also with us is Robin Autry. She's Associate Professor of Sociology at Wesleyan University and author of Desegregating the Past, The Public Life of Memory in the United States and South Africa. Robin, thank you for being here as well.
Happy to join you.
Robin, I want to start with you because you wrote this week about this debacle at UNC, and I found your discussion of tenure and its purposes to be really insightful. So, you know, just in the briefest sense, can you help our listeners understand why tenure exists and ideally how it's earned?
Sure. Yeah. So tenure, one of the main functions of it is to provide this academic freedom, which operates something like freedom of speech. But to have this protection in terms of the things you write about, the things you teach about, to have more freedom and to take more risk than maybe you felt comfortable taking when you didn't have tenure. So when someone's hired as an assistant professor, if they're on the tenure track, they have, you know, anywhere from 5 to 6 years to build up this profile, which consists of work that they've done as a scholar, the writing you've done, whether that's in articles or books, but also your performance in the classroom, how your students evaluate you, and then what service you've done on campus in terms of mentoring and advising, and then service that you've done in the discipline more broadly, like with professional associations. And you put together a file, and that gets reviewed by your department. It gets reviewed by outside colleagues from other universities who are experts in your field. And then that moves through several stages, like a university committee, a president, all before it gets to a board of trustees.
So I just want to point out as well that the Knight chairs, right, are endowed chairs that are specifically for non-traditional candidates. They're for candidates who are, in fact, doing work in the context of American journalism. So like right up the road from UNC at Duke is Bill Adair, and he's the founder of PolitiFact, not an academic in the traditional sense, but right, sits in a Duke University Knight chair, and there are like 25 of them around the country. So Pedro, I want to come to you. Like obviously as a dean, you are part of that other parts of the process that Robin was just talking about, right? You get that first vote and then you move on up through the process. Given the work you do managing faculty hiring and promotions, talk to us a little bit about how it might be different at a public university like UNC versus a private university like USC.
Well, I think sadly, at a public university, there's more room for political interference. The Board of Trustees at UNC, as you pointed out, the early part are not themselves academics. They're people appointed by the governor because of their connections to the governor, and who are much more susceptible to the political whims of the state and of the country. In contrast to a private university, which can buffer itself from some of those political winds. And you know, I myself served on the Board of Trustees for the State University of New York, appointed by the governor. So I'm familiar with the process, but I'm also familiar with how outrageous and out of the norm it is for a board to step into a tenure decision. This is so far outside of their realm of responsibility that that by itself is shocking.
So I think that shock that you're describing, Robin, that is, I think, what has been so galvanizing for so many of us in higher ed. You know, in the past week and a half or so, all of these organized groups of faculty, students, community members really speaking out about this. I mean, I noted that Sean Wilentz, who was one of the, you know, most vocal critics of the 1619 Project, actually wrote for the Chronicle of Higher Ed that denying, you know, tenure to Hannah Jones was a travesty. What does this one case, Robin, for you signal about something larger in the process of higher ed and of tenure?
Right. For me, even though I had that similar sense of shock that someone who's been influential and has just achieved so much in her career and received these rewards like the MacArthur Genius Grant and Pulitzer Prize, that these kind of clear exceptions were being made to the rule in terms of how tenure was being granted for this endowed chair and then for positions in a school of journalism in general. But then also I recognized something familiar. I thought, oh, you know, this sort of reminds me in this really extreme way of the sort of challenges and obstacles that a lot of Black faculty face when they're going up for tenure, feeling like there's like the process is mysterious, like the rules might shift, like the standards are constantly changing. Even as we feel we're meeting the expectations, it seems like sometimes those expectations are changing and that maybe we have to do more. We're not sure how much more and if we are ever reaching this target that seems to be moving constantly.
Listen, Robin, when you talk about it feeling familiar, I mean, it was one of those moments where the moment I read the headline, you know, again, I've been an academic college professor for, 22 years or something. And as soon as I read the headline, like my stomach just turned over with that sense of familiarity of the ways that these institutions within higher ed that we love so much, right, that we want to give our work and ourselves to, often don't love us back. So Pedro, let me come to you on this, because not only are you a dean, not only do you have an earned PhD and an academic and all of that, but you also actually study education and particularly these kinds of inequities within education. It seems worth noting that fewer than 2% of all full professors at American universities and colleges are Black women. What? How should we read the race and gender piece in addition to the politics piece in this case?
Just a clear sign that there are so many obstacles that are both explicit, but also the glass ceiling that keep talented people like Nicole Hannah-Jones. Her accomplishments as a journalist are without question. And the fact that someone of her caliber would be denied tenure is just shocking. It sends a shockwave throughout academia, but it sends a shockwave, I think, to Black women, women of color around the country, that regardless of what you do, your accomplishments can still be questioned by people who have no basis, no standing, simply because the politics are deemed to be outside the norm. And anybody familiar with Nicole's work knows that she has, despite her youth, just a broad accomplishments as a journalist, not only for the New York Times, but for others, which is why she won the MacArthur Genius Award. So when someone of her caliber is attacked in this way, it does send a shockwave. This is not, aside from the attack on tenure, this is censorship. And anyone against censorship should be outraged as well, because that's what this represents.
You know, you talk here about the shockwave, and in certain ways, it feels like that's kind of the point, right? To make a point that someone who is an actual certified genius, right, from winning the MacArthur Award, can be denied tenure. That it's meant to be a cautionary tale. And I'll also point out every other knight chair that has been hired with tenure. So this is in fact highly unusual. So back to you, Professor Noguera, why should anyone care if they're not a college professor? How is this issue connected to, folks who might be sending their kids to college or people who just pay taxes in their state?
Well, as I was saying a little earlier, Melissa, this is really about censorship. And what it means is that if you're in certain states now, you're not going to be exposed to certain information about this country, about the history of slavery, about the history of genocide, about the various atrocities that have made this country what it is today. And because we see that similar moves are being made in Texas, in Montana even, and Idaho to ban critical race theory, the irony is that many of the legislatures that are adopting these laws can't even explain what it is they don't like about critical race theory or about the 1619 Project. So it's motivated by a real ignorance, but the damage will be felt for many years to come in what students will not be able to learn. And that, I think, is the most damaging of all.
Robin, I was thinking, sorry, Professor Autry, I want to make sure that I get that right. Professor Autry, I want to go to this tweet that that Nicole Hannah-Jones sent out on May 20th, because I have to admit it sort of broke my heart. She tweeted out, "I've been overwhelmed by all the support you have shown me. It has truly fortified my spirit and my resolve. You all know I will be okay, but this fight is bigger than me. I will try my best not to let you down." I think if it had ended with "this fight is bigger than me," I wouldn't have felt quite so devastated by it. But that idea of "I will try my best not to let you down" is a lot of pressure, and it feels exceedingly common and brutal for Black women in the academy. This should, from my perspective, have just been a celebratory press release, right? UNC hires its alum. But instead, right, it becomes this whole entire debacle.
Right, and I felt the same when I saw that tweet. I could I could feel and sense all of that pressure, and I could relate to it on a smaller scale, but just thinking how so much is on our shoulders. We're meant to do this work of like representing a collective in addition to our individual work. And we're often like treated as the face of that collective. And that is a lot of extra pressure that goes along with a job that people who, our white colleagues don't necessarily have that on their shoulders. They get to be like individuals, and there's not this like historical fight that they're always waging in their work that can be tiring.
Professor Nogueira, I have to say, I have been a pretty strong proponent of this idea of free speech on campuses. And, you know, maybe not the way that it is framed in our particular partisan moment, but I do believe that, you know, part of the value of higher ed is our ability to put all ideas on the table, good ones, bad ones, horrifying ones, take a look at them, walk around them, not be afraid of them. Given that so many on the right have pressed this issue of free speech on campus for the past half decade, how do they square this positionality relative to Nicole Hannah-Jones?
Well, this is the enormous contradiction. Just recently, they were complaining, the right, about the cancel culture, that the cancel culture was canceling certain individuals. And this is the ultimate cancel culture. They've canceled Nicole Hannah-Jones simply because they don't like what she says, they don't like what she writes about. And when this is allowed to occur at our universities, what it does is it stifles debate, it stifles the free expression of ideas, it completely undermines our commitment as a country to pluralism in academia. And so the attack is, I think, much more serious than a single individual. In that way, she's right, Nicole Hannah-Jones is a symbol of a much broader attack that's occurring in academia that's being waged by the right now.
Professor Autry, it struck me as this kind of diametrically opposed reality that at the same time the news about Hannah-Jones being denied tenure broke, was the same time that Howard University was announcing that the legendary actress Felicia Rashad is now going to serve as the new dean of their School of Fine Arts. And I have enough HBCU friends, family, colleagues, students, you know, who said, hey, why are y'all trying to climb that academic ladder at PWIs anyway? Why not simply seek roles at HBCUs? How might you respond to that?
Yes, excellent. I think that's a great point. And that is part of what we're not talking about as much, like what it means to be Black faculty at predominantly white universities. And that's a different experience than what one would have at a HBCU in thinking about where we do land, right? We go on the market to find a job and we apply for the jobs that are listed and available. And it's a really tight market. You know, you can't always be so selective about where you're going to go in terms of who offers you a tenure track job. And the one thing I wanted to say about Nicole Hannah-Jones is thinking about her on that predominantly white campus. And I keep thinking about her hair. Sometimes too much gets made of Black women and their hair, but I think her hair is making all sorts of statements. It's big, it's bright, it's red. And it really says something about her refusal to just blend in or try to fit into the status quo, that she is taking risks, she's daring, she's playful. Her work says that, and she says that. And that's not exactly the type of way that people expect Black professors to fit in at white campuses.
I love that. It's the aesthetics of how we as Black women do our work. Professor Robin Autry, Associate Professor of Sociology at Wesleyan University, and Dean Pedro Nogueira, Dean and Distinguished Professor at USC in the School of Education. Thank you both for joining me.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks so much.
Just a quick note to let you all know, we invited Nicole Hannah-Jones to be part of this conversation. And anytime she'd like to make time for us, we would love to hear from her on this topic or probably lots of others. We also reached out to the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill's School of Journalism and Media. Susan King, Dean of the school, sent us a statement, which you can read online at thetakeaway.org. Last week, Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed Texas SB 8 into law. The law prohibits abortions as early as 6 weeks into pregnancy, if a fetal heartbeat is detected, a stage when many people are unaware they are pregnant and are therefore unable to make a choice. The law also institutes an innovated new enforcement strategy, allowing anyone to sue abortion providers and to recover up to $10,000. Republican state lawmakers in Texas made abortion restrictions a top priority item for their legislative session. And Governor Abbott framed his support for these actions as rooted in a fundamental concern about protecting life. Last week, Governor Abbott also issued an executive order prohibiting all government entities in the state from mandating masks. With me now to discuss this new law is Dr. Gazala Moyeti, an OBGYN abortion provider in Texas and a board member with Physicians for Reproductive Health. Dr. Moyeti, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa. It's an honor.
Oh, I feel very much the same way. Honored to have you, particularly given this new context in which you're attempting to do your work. So before we get into the details, can you just describe for us a bit what you've seen happen over time, over the past few years, maybe the past 10, as a doctor and an abortion provider in Texas?
Yeah, so I have been providing abortion care, whether it's as a physician or as a clinic worker, since 2004 here in Texas. So quite a while, and I've seen a lot of changes over the past decade. And the trend has been every legislative session to introduce new extreme laws that attempt to chip away at the right to access abortion. And this has been the strategy for over a decade. Each session to introduce some new way of putting a barrier up, making the time take longer, making it be a certain type of physician, a certain type of procedure. So really nitpicking at each detail of an abortion visit to try and block every step.
And is that kind of legislative action about each aspect of a medical procedure common in other medical procedures? For example, say kidney dialysis.
Of course not. And I, as an OBGYN, couldn't speak to the regulations around kidney dialysis, but I can tell you the regulations around all other aspects of gynecology and obstetrics. And I don't see this anywhere else. We don't see this kind of attention paid to the health and wellness and outcomes of birthing people in our state, for sure. We don't see this kind of attention to health and outcomes for people diagnosed with gynecologic cancers in this state, cervical cancer, ovarian cancer, uterine cancer. So the legislator does not spend each session worrying about the health of reproductively capable people at other stages in life, certainly.
So as an OBGYN, can you talk to me a little bit about what the dangers of pregnancy are, especially for some particular populations of people?
We know that, of course, pregnancy is a normal process. I don't want to focus so much on pathologizing it. People have normal, healthy pregnancies all the time. But as an OBGYN, I'm also there with folks when things go terribly wrong. And we can see death and harm from pregnancy happening at all stages of pregnancy, first trimester, second trimester, third trimester. And certainly we see the majority of deaths happening after birth. In Texas specifically, but around the country, this disproportionately impacts Black communities, Brown communities, other people of color, queer communities. And so people that are disproportionately already marginalized in our state, disenfranchised from so many other aspects of our government and our electoral process, are also being impacted by health outcomes throughout pregnancy.
So let's talk a little bit more about the bill itself. It has been described as the heartbeat bill. What do you think of that? What is the purpose? And is it an accurate description?
Thank you so much for asking that question. The purpose of naming it the heartbeat bill is to really sensationalize what's happening, to evoke an emotion in people. But you're exactly right. It is not a medically accurate term. What we're talking about is very clearly a complete ban on abortion. That is what this bill is. And it is being called a heartbeat bill so that legislatures, the governor, can correlate it with saving life. However, this stage of pregnancy that we're talking about, if we really want to get into the weeds of it, we're not talking about when a heart has been developed. We're talking about very early embryonic human development, when the cardiac cells are there and they are beating and they are forming a heart. They're starting to form a tube and to fold and to make chambers, but that hasn't happened yet. We're talking about before even a heart has formed. And I really want to name something very real as I get into those weeds of what a heartbeat even means. It doesn't matter when the heartbeat starts. It doesn't matter when the organs develop. It doesn't matter what the overwhelming scientific evidence proves as far as abortion care being exceedingly safe or around abortion restrictions actually causing harm to public health. We know that this isn't about human development. It's not about safety. It's not about efficacy. It's not about health care. And it's certainly not about saving the lives of babies in Texas. I'll say that we recently have a study published out of the University of California showing that exposure to fatal police violence during pregnancy increases the likelihood of preterm birth. And that's real facts. So if Texas lawmakers actually cared about the health and wellness of embryos in Texas, they should have spent this session preventing those murders, preventing murders like Botham Jean, Tatiana Jefferson, and Sandra Bland here in our state from happening. That's how they really could have used science to help our communities. But instead, they're wasting our time talking about heartbeats.
State violence is a reproductive justice issue. I so appreciate the way that you connected that for us. When you are talking to your patients as a provider at this point, how are you going to be talking to them about what their options are?
You know, it's going to be hard. And unfortunately, it's not something we're new to here in Texas. About a year ago now, the governor shut down abortion care in our state under the guise of a public health emergency. That day when our services were shut down was at that point the worst day of my career. We spent time every night calling patients, telling them we weren't open yet, trying to connect them with services across the country. I have colleagues in Alabama, in Chicago, in DC, that were seeing patients that I had cared for, but I couldn't complete their procedures because of the law. And so that's really what I fear is going to be happening. But people show up. And I'll tell you a story. Last session, a bill was introduced here that really we thought was the most extreme. But as I said, every session they surprise us. That bill called for essentially the consequence would be the death penalty for people seeking abortion and for physicians providing that care. Now, that bill didn't make it very far. Some Republicans said it was just way too extreme. They didn't want to punish pregnant people. But that week they were discussing the bill, I still had patients show up. And I remember a patient told me, "Doc, they're going to give me the death penalty for this, and I don't care. I have to get this abortion." That really kicked me in the gut.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that story and for the ways that it clarifies just how urgent this question is. Dr. Ghazala Moyeti is an OBGYN abortion provider in Texas and a board member with Physicians for Reproductive Health. Please take good care of yourself in the coming weeks.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Have a great day.
The publishing industry is in a bit of a bind. Recently, there's been a number of controversies surrounding book deals for former Trump administration officials and other polarizing figures. Just last month, more than 200 employees at Simon & Schuster signed a petition calling for the publishing company to cancel its deals with former Vice President Mike Pence and former Trump senior advisor Kellyanne Conway. Simon & Schuster is far from the only major publisher grappling with the question of who exactly should get a book deal. This is a debate playing out across the industry right now. So, which authors deserve the platform and resources of these publishers, and who gets to decide if and when they don't? And to walk us through that question and more, we're joined by Constance Grady, culture writer at Vox. Constance, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So let's start with this open letter from the Simon and Schuster staffers. What exactly were they calling for? Was it simply to cancel certain book deals, or was it broader than that?
It was a little bit broader than that. They wanted Simon and Schuster to cancel the Pence book deal, to also commit to refusing to sign any other members of the Trump administration. And they also wanted Simon and Schuster to end association with an independent press that Simon & Schuster has a distribution deal with, which came under a lot of scrutiny earlier this spring because it had signed a book deal with John Mattingly, one of the cops who shot at Breonna Taylor.
So help me understand how the general public sees these questions as well. We saw some reactions on social media.
Mm-hmm. There was a lot of social media outcry. There was also a lot of people signing this petition sort of in solidarity with the staffers at Simon & Schuster who did not want to work on these books. Some of them included prominent authors who work for Simon & Schuster, including Jesmyn Ward, who is the only woman ever to win two National Book Awards. There's been a lot of outcry from people who feel that that figures like Mike Pence and other people who work in the Trump administration don't deserve to have the resources of a major publisher at their disposal. At the same time, there's also a number of people who really do like these figures and support them and think that they should have book deals. And there are other people sort of in the middle who will sometimes argue that taking a book deal away from someone is the same as censorship and that a publisher should never concern itself with such issues.
Yeah, so let me go to exactly that point. And we spent the first part of our episode today talking about Nicole Hannah-Jones and the decision by the UNC trustee board to deny her tenure. So help me understand how this is any different. These are ideas. They're ideas that clearly some people will pay for. At this point, we don't know that the books would be full of things that are inaccurate, right? Presumably that would occur in the, you know, fact-checking would occur in the context of the editorial process. So isn't it simply a matter of a form of censorship?
Well, one thing that I want to flag in what you just said is that, in fact, most book publishers don't have fact-checking as part of their editorial process. That's one of the ways that book publishing is different than magazine publishing. Book publishers will sort of have it included in the contract that the author is supposed to make sure that anything that they've put into a nonfiction book is definitely true. But they don't generally connect authors with fact checkers. They don't sort of loop it into the editorial process in the same way that, for instance, copy editing is looped in. That's one of the reasons.
I sort of feel like books that are labeled nonfiction now need to come with like a government warning that's like, right? What's in this book may or may not be true.
Truly, this is part of the reason why you'll sometimes get a lot of outcry about these books from figures who built up a big following on Fox News is these books are being sold as nonfiction, but, you know, they haven't really necessarily been checked over. And they're often written by people who have demonstrated a limited concern for the truth in their public lives. You know, Kellyanne Conway has a book deal with Simon & Schuster's imprint Threshold Books, and she coined the term alternative facts. So how can the public trust that what she writes is going to be true?
Now, given that we're talking about Simon & Schuster, one might also bring up the, you know, books by John Bolton, and also by the former president's niece, Mary Trump. Weren't they also published by this same press?
Yeah, they were. And this is an interesting sort of paradox of publishing. I think there's, on the one hand, this sort of idealistic idea from a lot of people in publishing that, you know, this is an industry that is supposed to display the widest possible amount of viewpoints towards readers and sort of put them out on the marketplace of ideas and let readers make up their own minds about them. I think what Simon & Schuster staffers have been saying is it's one thing to publish books by figures that we can trust have rigorously checked their own work. And it's another thing to put forth ideas into the marketplace of ideas that we are pretty sure have not been checked and are may potentially be harmful.
So help me to think about what all of this says about the publishing industry, about its goals and its own understanding of itself within our current society.
Yeah, I think this is a really major question that a lot of these industries are facing as they try to move away from the monolithic whiteness of the gatekeepers of culture. Publishing, last I checked, was about 79% white, and that really affects the stories that are told and the people who get the resources to put their stories out there.
Okay, Constance, sit tight. We have a little bit more coming up, and when we get back, we're going to talk about the buzziest books of summer.
Want to be a part of the takeaway? Record your take as a voice memo on your phone. Email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com and make your voice heard. Or call us at 877-869-8253.
On this week's On the Media, what happened to the offbeat, irreverent, speaking truth to power alt weeklies that used to populate newsstands across the country?
The Voice was their guide to life from people who cared about what they were covering with such intensity that there were fistfights and brawls inside the paper. That's gone.
The end of an era on this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Back with you on The Takeaway, I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Around this time every year, we see list after list of the buzziest books about to hit the shelves, from beach reads to engrossing nonfiction. There will be no shortage of options at your local library or neighborhood bookstores this summer. And it turns out a lot of you are already turning to books to beat the heat.
Hi, this is Deanna from Massapequa Park. A great summer reading might be The Third Pole by Mark Sinnott, reading about climbing Mount Everest and the history of adventures to Mount Everest. Really made me feel very cool while I was sitting in the sun finishing that excellent novel. Thank you so much.
Hi, my name is Denise McQuinn. I'm calling from Dallas, Texas. Anything by Tom Robbins. He's a great writer and he makes you laugh out loud. Carl Hyacin, I love his writing style and humor too.
Hi, my name is Amy and I'm calling from Ferndale, Washington. Right now I'm reading Butter, Honey, Pig Bread by Francesca Ekwuyati. It's about Nigerian twin sisters who are coming together in their mother's house in Lagos after spending years apart in different parts of the Anglo world. The theme of how family breaks apart and comes back together feels very relevant to me.
As always, our listeners have lots of great recommendations, but I know I like to have a big stack of books ready for the summer. So we've got you covered if you're like that. Back with us is Constance Grady, culture writer at Vox. So Constance, you were saying that, you know, obviously the industry is interested in being able to actually sell text, right? Sell books. And these books, right? The kinds of things that we all sit by the pool with or at the beach, or maybe even just like try to sneak and read in the car while you're dropping your kid off at camp. This is where, you know, some of that real reading time happens. So what are some of your specific recommendations for good summer books?
Yeah, well, one book that I'm really excited for that I think fits into what we were talking about in the previous segment really well is The Other Black Girl. This is a debut novel by Zakiya Delilah Harris. It was a really, really fought over, anticipated book. It sold at auction for, I think, seven figures. And it is about a young woman, a Black girl, who is an editorial assistant at a big publishing house. And then one day they hire another Black girl so that there are finally two of them. And at first our heroine sort of thinks, oh, this will be great. We'll be able to have solidarity. I'll finally have someone I can talk to in the office. But then things slowly become more and more sinister. It's a really fun read, but it's also really interested in these questions that publishing as an industry is facing right now about this sort of industry that thinks of itself as being really liberal and progressive, but is still mostly made up of white people, and why that is, what the structural issues are that lead to these problems, and how it affects the books that they put out into the world.
I have absolutely been anticipating that book. I cannot wait to read it. I've carved out time for this summer. You know, I'm also kind of interested in thinking about how artists, how novelists are writing about the pandemic. And I'm wondering if we have books that are coming out in this summer or that maybe are already on our shelves that help us to maybe reflect on what we've all just been living through.
Yeah, there are a couple of the first wave of nonfiction books about the pandemic have come out. I just finished reading The Premonition by Michael Lewis. He's a Vanity Fair journalist. He also is the author of Moneyball. This is a really interesting book because it's mostly about the figures who did see the pandemic coming and were able to predict it pretty accurately and figure out what, as it turned out, really effective public health measures would have been for it. And then kind of infuriatingly, it's about the ways that they were all sidelined from decision making and we ended up in the crisis state we found ourselves in. It's incredibly infuriating to read, but there's also something sort of calming about seeing these experts figure out what's happening and sort of place order over this year of chaos. Another one that's also sort of in a similar vein is The Plague Year by Lawrence Wright. He writes for The New Yorker. He's won a Pulitzer for his nonfiction previously. And that one's just sort of kind of going through all of the wild events of 2020, not only COVID, but also everything that happened with the election and with Trump and with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And it's very, very, what's interesting about Wright is that he has a lot of access to major political figures. So he's able to bring in quotes from all of these players who are actually involved with everything. And you kind of find yourself in the cockpit of this year of chaos and can sort of see how everything went so terribly wrong. So we're getting two different perspectives on all of the horrors of last year. And it's really, really enraging to read, but also pretty clarifying.
Now, we're moving into June next week, which is Pride Month. And Tori Peters has a text, Detransition Baby. And it's gotten a lot of praise for how it sort of addresses trans experiences. Tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah, so Detransition Baby deals with two trans women who are exes, and one of them is in the process of actually detransitioning. So she was living as a trans woman for a while, and now she's decided that she's happier going back to life as a man. It's a really interesting novel because the idea of people who detransition has kind of been used as a political cudgel a lot. You know, this sense that, you know, not everyone's really committed to transitioning, so we should somehow make it harder for them to do it in ways that are really not helpful and really not nuanced. But this book is able to make that experience really personal and really embedded in the trans experience. I read it and I thought the writing was so playful and lovely, but I wasn't sure I was really qualified to say how it handled trans issues authentically. But Emily Vanderwerf, my colleague at Vox, who's our critic at large and is a trans woman and writes really beautifully about trans issues, she said that she read it and it was like someone had reached inside of her and pulled out all of her deepest, darkest feelings about being trans and then just showed them to the world so everyone could see her guts and stuff.
Oh, well, that is both a fantastic and also exactly what you want a book to do, to be kind of disruptive and discomforting in that way. We're going to be signing off, but I do have to say I love that the June pick for the Vox Book Club is Rahman Alam's Leave the World Behind. I read that sucker in one night. I love that book. I cannot suggest it enough for folks.
It's so fun. It's just a great vacation book because it's the world's worst vacation, so yours will feel much, much more fun.
It really is true. Constance Grady is a culture writer at Vox. Constance, thank you for being here and for all your recommendations.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hi, this is Vicki. I'm calling from Pahoa, Hawaii. Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie is a great summer read.
Hi, this is Kathy Licht in San Rafael, California. I'm currently reading The Nest. It's a good summer read, it has great characters, and just a nice light read.
And that's the show for today, y'all. I really enjoy being here with you and appreciate you tuning in. Thanks so much for spending part of your day with us. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.